When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Hope you've had a great week so far. In this podcast, I want to talk a little bit about metabolic adaptation. But before we get into that, I have a few announcements. First up, we've just published a number of free resources on our resource page that you may find helpful. So we developed and released these calculators to help determine your target daily calories, macronutrients, heart rate zones for conditioning, one rep maxes using RPE, and more. And we've also included our top articles and videos on training, nutrition, and pain as a sort of barbell medicine's greatest hits. Now, I've linked the page in the show notes below, but you can also get there by heading to our website, clicking About Us, then Resources. Second, our Android app is now live on the Google Play Store. It's free to download and use, so if you're an Android-using barbell medicine fan, please go check that out. Lastly, we get a lot of questions about our training templates, specifically which ones do we recommend. So I took some time and built an algorithm to codify my recommendations, which now exists as a sort of quiz to help you select your next training program. This is also linked in the show notes below, and I should also point out that if you want to check out any of our templates, you get a free one-week sample, including our pain and rehab templates. It's also on the website. Just go over, click the template that you want, and there's a free one-week template just waiting there for you, so you can check that out. All right, that's it for announcements. Let's talk about metabolic adaptation. So metabolic adaptation is a greater than expected reduction in the amount of calories used in a day in response to a diet and or weight loss. So as people lose weight, we expect their energy requirements to go down in proportion to the amount of weight that they lose. As both fat and muscle tissue, they both use energy all day, every day. So if a person loses weight and the amount of energy that they use in a day goes down out of proportion to the amount of weight that they've lost, that's called metabolic adaptation or adaptive thermogenesis. Now, to be clear, there's no consensus on what this term actually means. Some define it as a change in resting metabolic rate that is greater than what would be predicted from the changes in muscle and fat mass. Others define it as a change in any source of energy expenditure, which includes resting energy expenditure, activity-related energy expenditure, and the energy used to digest, store, and metabolize food, which was called diet-induced energy expenditure. Now, for the purposes of this podcast, we'll describe adaptive thermogenesis or metabolic adaptation as changes in the resting metabolic rate that are greater than would be predicted for a given change in body mass. But before we go any further, and I've already used some jargon about energy expenditure, calories, metabolic rate, and so on. Yeah, I know that many of you are familiar with these terms, but let's briefly cover some definitions to ensure that we're all on the same page. So let's start out with energy and calories. Now, calories are a unit of measurement used to measure energy, much in the same way that seconds are used to measure time and kilograms are used to measure mass. So when someone asks, is a calorie, the answer is unequivocally yes. It's just a unit of measurement. Now, technically speaking, a calorie with a lowercase c is the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. Our food contains thousands of times more energy than this, so rather than using the term kilocalories when measuring the energy in food, this term has been abbreviated as calories with an uppercase c. To add to the confusion over units, researchers and professionals in the nutrition field are faced with a problem. Neither the calorie with a capital C or calorie with a lowercase c are used in the international system, the SI system, for measuring energy. Instead, the joule and kilojoule are the SI units for measuring energy, where 1 joule is the amount of work done by a force of 1 newton moving an object 1 meter in the direction of the force. Now, in many countries, foods are labeled in kilojoules and not calories. This is also true of some research papers. But for the purposes of this podcast, we'll discuss energy in terms of calories. For example, total daily energy expenditure, which is sometimes abbreviated TDEE, is the total amount of calories, with a capital C, used or, quote, burned in a day. There are three components of TDEE, and they are the resting energy expenditure, the diet-induced energy expenditure, and the third is called activity-induced or activity-related energy expenditure. Now, the relative contributions of total daily energy expenditure from each of these components are approximately 60% for resting energy expenditure, 10% for diet-induced energy expenditure, and 30% for activity-related energy expenditure. Okay, let's cover each one of these components. So resting energy expenditure is the amount of energy used to sustain basic life processes such as breathing, heart function, and other essential tissue functions while an individual is awake. Resting metabolic rate, or RMR, is the rate at which the body expends energy to sustain these functions, whereas resting energy expenditure is the total amount of energy used in 24 hours. Now, resting metabolic rate is often confused with basal metabolic rate, or BMR, and while they are similar measures, the difference is that the measuring BMR requires a full 12-hour fast beforehand, and measurements of resting metabolic rate tend to be about 10% higher than basal metabolic rate. Still, it accounts for about 60 to 80% of total daily energy expenditure, and the majority of an individual's resting metabolic rate, or RMR, is determined by the amount of lean body mass that they have, which includes muscle, vital organs, extracellular fluids, and bone, although some authors don't include this. In general, higher amounts of lean body mass result in a higher resting metabolic rate. Same thing with higher body weights in general. There's just more mass that requires more energy to sustain it. And conversely, having a lower level of lean body mass or a lower body weight in general results in a lower resting metabolic rate and a reduced resting energy expenditure. Now, this is an important relationship to understand, as a reduction in metabolic rate that is out of proportion to the amount of body mass lost is the basis for metabolic adaptation. But before we go on, let's talk about the other two components of total daily energy expenditure. That is diet-induced energy expenditure and activity-related energy expenditure. Starting with diet-induced energy expenditure, which is also known as the thermic effect of food, or TEF, well, that describes the energy required to digest, absorb, transport, and store energy from the food that we eat. Now, one way to think about TEF, or the thermic effect of food, is that it represents the energy expenditure increase from baseline within the first 3 to 4 hours of eating a meal. In this view, the thermic effect of food represents the 10 to 15% increase in energy expenditure after eating, which peaks at 1 to 2 hours before gradually returning to baseline. Now, overall, the greater the calorie intake and/or the protein intake and/or the fiber intake, well, that increases the energy requirements for digestion, absorption, and storage, and you get a larger thermic effect of food value. Now, there are a number of other factors that alter the thermic effect of food, including age, body composition, physical activity, and other meal-specific factors like meal size, composition, how often someone's eating, and timing. But overall, the thermic effect of food, again, it's a short-term response to eating a meal, and there's little evidence that this adapts significantly in response to weight loss or predicts weight management overall. All right, last up is activity-related energy expenditure. Now, this refers to the calories or energy used during exercise and non-exercise activity. Now, non-exercise activity thermogenesis is abbreviated NEAT, and it's further broken down into voluntary behavioral activities like walking, climbing stairs, household chores, and so on, and then also involuntary activities such as fidgeting, twitches, frequent standing, and/or other unconscious movements. Now, activity-related energy expenditure is the most variable component of total energy expenditure, and it's typically between 20 to 40% of someone's total daily energy expenditure. The energy cost of a physical activity has a dose-dependent relationship with activity-specific factors such as intensity, duration, the muscle mass being used, and the economy of movement. Now, increases in exercise intensity, duration or volume, and the amount of muscle mass being used, well, that tends to increase the amount of calories being used for an activity. Now, on the other hand, the energy expended during formal exercise does not significantly change during weight loss per se. However, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, or the energy being used from non-exercise activities, that's called NEAT, well, that can change significantly. Now, many individuals will spontaneously move less and/or burn less calories during non-exercise activities, for example, and this can lead to large differences in weight management trajectories and body composition. For example, a study of 140 insufficiently active adults with overweight or obesity were randomized to an exercise protocol burning either 400 or 600 calories per session, 5 days a week for 10 months. About half the study group lost over 5% of their initial body weight during the study, and they were called responders, whereas the other half did not lose this much weight, and they were termed non-responders. Now, the daily energy expenditure was measured during a two-week period near the end of the study using doubly labeled water and also during exercise using indirect calorimetry. Now, during the exercise itself, there were no differences in the amount of calories being used, but the responders had a much higher total daily energy expenditure than the non-responders, suggesting that energy expenditure from either non-exercise activity or resting metabolic rate were reduced in those who didn't lose weight. The current thinking is that this is predominantly due to genetics. Okay, so now that we've discussed the components of energy expenditure, we need to talk about what happens to it when people lose weight. Now, we know that the main determinants of resting metabolic rate and subsequent energy expenditure are lean body mass and total body mass. Thus, when people lose weight, we would predict that their total daily energy expenditure will go down proportionally to the amount and type of mass lost, where a kilo of muscle uses about 13 calories per day and a kilo of fat uses about 4.5 calories per day. Now, with that in mind, changes in body weight typically produce changes in both lean and fat mass. The proportional change in lean and fat mass varies among individuals and depends on many factors, including the level of energy intake, diet composition, baseline adiposity, baseline body fat, activity level, genetics, health status, age, and more. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert, so you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month, and all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required, that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3 month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, there is this, quote, one-fourth fat-free mass rule when it comes to relevant contributions of fat and lean mass during weight loss. The prediction that approximately one-fourth of weight loss will be lean mass and the remaining three-fourths will be fat mass comes from a research group in the 1980s who found that the average proportion of, quote, excess weight in the individuals with obesity being studied was about 22% lean mass and 78% fat mass. Therefore, they predicted that weight loss should ideally consist of the same proportion, which was rounded to 25% lean and 75% fat mass. Voila, the one-fourth fat-free mass rule was born. However, this rule was more of an approximation than anything else, as there are a number of variables that can affect the proportions of fat and lean mass loss. First up, when the measurement is made can affect the observed ratio of fat to muscle loss. Now, weight loss occurs in two different phases, with the first phase being shorter and highlighted by greater losses of lean mass than fat mass, where most of the lean mass being lost is water. The second phase is longer and has proportionally greater fat mass loss. Now, both of these phases are combined when researchers measure fat and lean mass changes at a single point, which is likely related to the variability in reported values of the amount of lean mass and fat mass being lost over time. Additionally, current evidence suggests that body composition changes during weight change depend on not only the direction and magnitude of the change, but also an individual's initial fat mass. Higher initial levels of fat mass tend to lead to a greater change in body fat during weight gain or weight loss. In other words, individuals with higher initial levels of fat mass tend to lose more fat mass proportionally when they lose weight, and they tend to gain more fat mass when gaining weight than leaner individuals. This is, again, likely due to genetics. Cutting down before you bulk is not necessarily the move. In fact, if you don't take a maintenance period, you're highly likely to restore that fat mass directly after. And finally, larger changes in body weight correlate with larger losses of lean mass than smaller changes in body weight do. And we see this with the anti-obesity medications and metabolic surgery. Again, you lose a bunch of weight, yep, you're going to tend to lose more lean body mass than smaller amounts of weight, but the benefits are worth the risk. It also matters how the energy deficit is created. Is it by diet, exercise, or both? So for example, one study admitted 7 pairs of identical twins to a clinical research facility for about 3 months. Now, the amount of calories needed to maintain their weight was directly measured, and they were given fixed portions of food throughout their stay to match this amount. In addition, they exercised on a bike every day to burn 580 calories, thereby creating an energy deficit. In this study of a, quote, exercise-induced energy deficit, the average weight loss was about 5 kilos, and 99% of this was fat mass, far better than the 1/4 fat-free mass rule would have predicted. Now, another study compared an exercise-induced energy deficit to a diet-induced deficit of about 500 to 700 calories per day in 52 adults with obesity. The exercise group did light jogging to create a deficit, while their diet was controlled at the maintenance calorie needs measured before the exercise intervention. Now, the diet-only group created the same deficit, but they did not exercise. Both groups lost the same amount of weight in 3 months, which was about 15 pounds. However, the amount of fat loss in the exercise group was about 3 pounds greater, and they actually gained a bit of muscle mass. That was probably water, but still, they fared better than the diet-only group. Meta-analysis on this topic finds that about 3/4 of studies only undertaking calorie restriction result in lean mass losses between 20 and 30%. Those that included exercise reduced lean mass losses by about half. Overall, the quarter fat-free mass loss rule is mostly an approximation and likely applies only to individuals who aren't exercising. Okay, with all of that in mind, we can finally discuss metabolic adaptation specifically. Again, we can predict the reduction in daily energy expenditure that's attributable to changes in body mass. Now, the predicted changes in energy expenditure for lean and fat mass loss alone are 19 and 4.5 calories per kilo per day, respectively. Again, weight loss is unlikely to be all fat or all muscle, so the resulting energy change is going to be somewhere in the middle. But wait, there's more. The reduced mass also costs less to move around, resulting in a less predictable reduction in activity-related energy expenditure as well. Again, if the person weighs less, it's going to cost them less energy to move around. And a number of studies have investigated this and arrived at an estimate of about 30 calories, that's the reduction in total daily energy expenditure, per kilogram of weight loss per day. Okay, so reductions in resting energy expenditure beyond this level could represent adaptive thermogenesis or metabolic adaptation due to changes in hormonal and other cellular signals that act to preserve energy balance. Now, during periods of energy restriction, that's like a calorie deficit, well, these changes may make active weight loss and weight loss maintenance more difficult. So let's take a closer look at the evidence on metabolic adaptation. So one of the earliest examples of metabolic adaptation during weight loss comes from the Minnesota semi-starvation study during World War II. 32 healthy young men aged 20 to 33 were subjected to about 6 months of a semi-starvation diet where they consumed half of their maintenance calories per day. The subjects lost about 1/4 of their initial body weight during the semi-starvation period, but this was only about 2/3 of what they were predicted to lose. They didn't lose nearly as much weight as what was calculated. So why didn't they lose as much as predicted, you ask? Well, the researchers found that the subjects' total daily energy expenditure was substantially reduced, which was initially attributed to an excessive reduction in resting metabolic rate. i.e. metabolic adaptation. However, subsequent analyses showed that the bulk of the reduction in total daily energy expenditure was from a reduction in physical activity, not metabolic adaptation. Now, this isn't to say that metabolic adaptation doesn't exist, but rather that its definition is important to its characterization. When we restrict the definition of metabolic adaptation to a greater than predicted change in resting metabolic rate alone after weight loss, well, existing data shows a relatively large inter-individual variability. Well-controlled studies show that changes in resting energy expenditure from weight loss can vary between a decrease of 337 calories per day all the way up to a 352 calorie per day increase. Yeah, you heard that right, an increase. Further, about half of individuals who lose weight and maintain it long-term have a reduction in resting energy expenditure greater than 40 calories per day, whereas 1 in 3 individuals show an increase in resting energy expenditure after weight loss. Now, metabolic adaptations tend to take about 2 weeks to become apparent, and it's most significant during periods of active weight loss, with a subsequent decline during periods of weight maintenance. Importantly, most available data show no correlation with the magnitude of metabolic adaptation and weight regain. These relationships hold true even in extreme cases of weight loss, such as individuals who have undergone gastric bypass surgery or participated in the Biggest Loser competition. A 2014 study compared 26 individuals who had undergone gastric bypass surgery to 16 contestants from The Biggest Loser and compared their measured resting metabolic rates to their predicted resting metabolic rates at various time points. At 6 months post-gastric bypass, individuals lost an average of 35.5 kilos and had evidence of metabolic adaptation worth about 200 calories per day. Now, weight loss increased to about 40 kilos at 1 year post-op. However, no adaptive thermogenesis or metabolic adaptation was evident at this time. At all time points, there was substantial inter-individual variation in measured metabolic adaptation. By comparison, the Biggest Loser contestants lost more weight, about 48.5 kilos at 7 months, and less lean mass compared to the gastric bypass group. Biggest Loser contestants lost an average of 16% lean mass, whereas the gastric bypass group lost about 30%. Now, at 7 months, the Biggest Loser contestants showed a metabolic adaptation of 419 calories per day, which again varied widely between individuals. However, individuals were still undergoing active weight loss at this time point, so it's unclear how meaningful that number is or how stable it was either. At the 6-year follow-up, however, the Biggest Loser contestants had a measured resting metabolic rate that was about 500 calories per day less than their predicted resting metabolic rate based on their age, height, weight, and so on. And this suggested a substantial metabolic adaptation. However, there was no correlation between metabolic adaptation, the magnitude of it, and weight regain. And furthermore, the individuals with the greatest sustained amount of weight loss had the greatest amount of metabolic adaptation that was measured. So taking all of this available data into consideration, it appears that metabolic adaptation varies significantly between individuals. When present, it seems to be mostly related to an individual's genetics and the amount of weight being lost. It's likely that very high levels of metabolic adaptation make it more difficult to lose and maintain weight loss long term, but it's unclear that this is unavoidable by adopting specific strategies relating to nutrition or exercise. While some recommend eating more and reverse dieting to, quote, increase their metabolism, there's no evidence that this actually happens or that it increases metabolic rate outside of causing weight gain, which does increase metabolic rate due to the new tissue that you gain using calories. Truth is, our metabolism doesn't really change that much throughout adulthood outside of body mass changes. Individuals with obesity do not have a slower metabolism, that is, a reduced amount of energy burned per kilogram body mass, than lean people. It's about the same. And individuals with a high metabolic rate, they gain the same amount of weight on average as individuals with a low metabolic rate over a year. So overall, metabolic adaptation is definitely a real thing. Changes in body weight produce changes in body mass levels, which in turn change resting energy expenditure. During periods of active weight loss, there's some evidence that some individuals' resting energy expenditure changes out of proportion to the change in lean body mass and fat mass. However, these changes vary substantially among individuals. Positive or negative, small or large, metabolic adaptation also appears to be unavoidable during periods of active weight loss, though it does seem to decrease during periods of weight stability. However, I don't think that metabolic adaptation plays a big role in weight management after weight loss, though it almost certainly does when people are trying to lose weight. The neural and hormonal feedback relating to appetite, feelings of fullness, and activity levels relating to weight loss is complex and variable between individuals, with much of this variability being of genetic origin. Those who have a harder time losing weight tend to have greater ratings of hunger, reduced feelings of fullness, and additional changes to the amount of energy they use per day, whether that's through reduced energy expenditure from non-exercise activity or otherwise. All these factors ultimately conspire against weight loss. We think this is related mostly to genetics, which speaks to the difficulty for many when it comes to achieving significant weight loss, let alone maintaining it. Consider our Biggest Loser contestants who lost an average of 48.5 kilos. That's nearly 110 pounds at 7 months. While the average level of metabolic adaptation, again, a reduction in resting metabolic rate out of proportion to the weight that's been lost, that was about 500 calories per day. But what about the folks who didn't lose as much? Would they have had a higher level of metabolic adaptation if they somehow were able to lose more weight? Did the higher level of metabolic adaptation prevent them from losing even more weight? It's likely, though it's more than just an individual's resting metabolic rate. It's their appetite, their feelings of fullness, the reduced activity, and more that combine together in an unfair way. And the same is true when it comes to overfeeding. A 2019 study had 35 adults consume an extra 1,158 calories daily for 8 weeks. Now, on average, subjects gained about 7.5 kilos, which varied significantly between individuals. The lowest end of the range was 2.3 kilos, and the highest end was 10.7 kilos. Now, the subject's daily energy expenditure increased by an average of 280 calories per day, which was mostly related to how much weight was gained. Those who gained more had a higher increase in energy expenditure, whereas those who didn't gain as much had a more modest increase. However, the main takeaway for me is the variance in the amount of weight gained when exposed to the same calorie surplus. Some folks gained as little as 5 pounds, whereas others gained more than 20 pounds. Metabolic adaptation aside, the variability in response to the same intervention highlights the complex nature of weight regulation. That's it for this episode of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. If you like this episode, please share it with a friend and leave us a 5-star review. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.